I'm Jason.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Usually Dave from the Digital Soup Podcast.
A proud member of the Gonna Geek Network, just like the show you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of each individual. Check out all the other podcasts
at GonnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness begins in 3,
2,
1.
Hello, I'm Colin Baker, known to my friends as Old Sixy, the sixth Doctor in that wonderful series Doctor Who. And I am proud to tell you are listening to me and also Gallifrey Public Radio, the radio that brings you everything from Doctor Who to Rhino Wants a Wife, which is a book written by Lucy Baker, my daughter. It's a children's book. You can get it from fbspublishing.co.uk, and it's about a rhinoceros who is lonely and wants a wife, and it's illustrated by my other daughter's boyfriend, and it's a bargain. Buy it!
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. We invite you to join us each week for discussions ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi and beyond. Your GPR staff are Jay Witten.
You see how clever I was there? You make that connection? Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Keir Hansen.
Proactive. Reactive. Proactive. I'm making up words as I go here.
And Haley Malley.
Hey, that wasn't exactly what I was going to say at all, Jay. Thanks.
Oh, and
spoilers.
We do occasionally discuss recent news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired in their home territories. But don't worry. If we dip too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning.
Welcome to episode 241 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we are the students who ultimately teach, the adventurers who find their home, the old souls who find new life again, the hyper-scheduled showrunners who realize that we're going to have to scale back on a few things before everything goes to hell in a handcart. I am your host, Haley Malley, and with me in the studios this week, we have Jay Witten. How are you today, Jay?
I'm doing spectacular.
And Keir Hansen. How are you, Keir?
Is it Christmas yet?
Yep, sure is. And joining us for a premiere appearance in the GPR studios, we have friend of the cast, fellow con panelist, and well-versed Whovian of note, Kathleen Showalter.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
So this week, we're going to take a look back on the trials and triumphs of the final season for Peter Capaldi as the 12th Doctor, and for Stephen Moffat, who has served as the showrunner since 2012. We're going to reflect on the goals and intentions of Series 10 as it was presented, and the work of Pearl Mackie as Bill Potts, the companion, Matt Lucas as Nardal, and the close of Michelle Gomez's tenure as the latest incarnation of the Master. Honestly, is there anything left for Chibnall to take over?
It's just an empty set. It's just him walking around. So you guys want to tell stories?
I think he's actually—he's not actually doing Doctor Who. He's just doing the spinoff about all the women who are now careening through time and space.
Pitched that show last week.
Yeah. There's going to be a score of them.
Definitely do it.
Yeah, none of them are ever going to die. You could just go forever.
It's a perfect
script. What happens though when the actors get old? There's a Doyleist problem here.
No, then they turn into a giant head in a jar retroactively. It's just, yeah.
It all comes back to John Barrowman.
Oh, boy. You know, you stay in fluid for too long, the body just swells and swells.
Ouch.
All right, so...
That was cold.
We figured that one of the things that I wanted to really kind of distinguish was that when we're talking about the overall theme of the series, because when Moffat was presenting this to us back months and months ago and we were leading into the pilot, he was talking about how this was going to be, you know, a very particular flavor of spectacular, and it was going to accomplish very specific things, and it was going to make us feel very high levels of feels, and using all of the particular adjectives that Mr. Moffat is wont to do. But I always try to distinguish between the tone of what it is that he's describing. Like, he said that Series 9 was going to be dark and dramatic. It absolutely was. You know, he delivered on that. And he said that this series was going to be a definite break from that and coming back to a familiar sort of format that we would recognize and so on and so on. But that differs wildly from the theme of the series, and both of those differ from the underlying message of the series. So I figured I'd kind of take those apart and throw them around the room here and see what we're walking away from looking at the episodes we've just seen. If I do ask you to, I don't know, I put them in a different order in the notes, but bear with me on this one. If we talk about the tone, because that was really, when we kick back from it, one of the first things when you're looking at all the episodes as a set, you think, God, you know, that season was considerably, you know, insert adjective here. Haley, how did you feel about the overall tone of the series, knowing the episodes in and of themselves differ wildly?
I feel like this season set out to do a lot of kind of lighthearted adventure, but the stories that weren't lighthearted adventure took up more space. Like, okay, the monk story took up 3 episodes, and, you know, the end with the Cybermen took up 2 episodes. So I feel like there were more adventure stories, but the ones that were not that, you know, ate up more time.
So the carrot and the stick that he was holding out for a while, saying we're going to get back to romps and adventures and lighthearted, you know, one and dones. Oh, except for this two-parter. Oh, except for this three-parter. Oh, except for this two-parter that's really a three-parter because I'm really not going to be done for another 4 months to come Christmas. All right. Jay, did you have a kind of an all-encompassing tone, or was there one at all to be said?
The way it kind of struck me was, and maybe this was just my own personal interpretation, just because I knew what was coming, it almost seemed like a winding down. Like, things were kind of, everything was pointed towards Capaldi's regeneration. And so, you know, there's a lot of closing up the loops, you know, tying up loose ends, things like that. And so it just seemed like a constant bit of closure. And okay. Like I said, that might be me just knowing what was going on behind the scenes, but it just felt that way through pretty much all the episodes, that it was just a, let's go ahead and finish this story and then put it away. Even if it's something that, you know, was just the one episode, they made sure that it was done and put it away.
Do you think that was really just the way that he was sort of presenting character as sort of being the only one really aware of the elephant in the room?
It's possible. I was just chalking it up to knowing how things were going behind the scenes.
Okay.
So I didn't really try and read too much into it because I thought it was just me putting it on there. Okay. Not really that. Right. Not really what it was set out to do.
Okay.
That said, there are a lot of endings in even the one and done, the one-off episodes. We have a lot of somebody is about to be killed, somebody is dead, someone is actually alive again. Like, there is a lot of independent individual closures throughout, which tonally kind of did set you up for endings overall. And I think that was in the text of the narrative or in the stories themselves, as well as in the fanish knowledge that the showrunner, the villain, the good guy, they're all leaving.
So would you all kind of agree that there was a bit of a tone of like waiting for the other shoe to drop, that whether it was on the small scale or whether we were getting a piece of what we knew was a longer story arc, it was just a matter of that anticipation of the finality that everybody was aware was coming. And it was just a matter of seeing how much inside baseball were we really going to see come through in each episode. You know, was the Doctor going to make some sort of a statement to the admission of his pending demise or something of that sort? Or was another character going to drop some sort of a hint that, oh, this will all be over soon or something like that? Did you have any of that sort of anticipatory feel watching any particular episode? I mean, maybe not the last two withstanding, but throughout, that we were going to be getting these breadcrumbs of disaster or, you know?
Yes, absolutely. Especially in the pilot. I think the pilot, particularly, so I, in preparation, I rewatched the pilot again right after watching the finale, just to look at them. And there's so much parallelism. It's almost as if, and this probably isn't what happened, certainly doesn't seem like Moffat, but that he wrote the finale, the pilot and the finale together because they pair. But particularly in this segment in the episode, the pilot, where you cross cut between Bill serving chips and the Doctor lecturing. and Bill being in the audience and the Doctor lecturing. And he's talking about how time happens all at once. And the day you are born, the day you die, the day you fall in love, the day that love ends, a whole city and it's falling apart. The best place you'll ever be, the worst place you'll ever be. Time is the space for our lives and we stand together forever. Like that could lead so easily into the finale. And it's positive, but it also has a sort of, the word I'm looking for is what you say at a funeral.
Why can't I think of that? Where's the snack table?
I'm Irish. It's where's the bar? But because yeah. We have wakes, but a sort of epitaph.
Okay.
A funeral oration, a looking back on a life, its highs and its lows, and an awareness that where you are today and the end are happening at the same moment.
Okay.
You say that you don't think he actually did. I wouldn't be surprised if he at least came up with themes for both episodes at the same time.
And themes, yes.
He knew this was his swan song. He knew this is how he was going to end his tenure with Doctor Who. I would not be surprised to find out that he crafted both the beginning and the end at the same time. And maybe even, the episode he did in the middle.
Yes, I would absolutely argue. Extremists would.
Of where the end was going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And extremists, yeah.
Well, let's bring that over because that's actually a really good entry point. So, talking about the distinction between the two, the series as a whole or certain episodes or keystone episodes like that might have a particular tone to them, but there is also thematically a link throughout the series. And I know some conversation, a pretty great conversation I was having a little earlier today, brought one to mind that I wish I could take credit for, but I can't. So I'm going to credit Julie on this one. So, but she articulated something that I couldn't. I'm not even going to put it out there because I want to see whether anyone else picked up on it first. But as far as a running theme throughout, and it really, I went back systematically and I jumped through each episode to see whether or not it actually mapped, and it does track pretty well, but I want to see if anyone else has what they think is a kind of a theme that seems to be pervasive through this particular series, knowing our characters, knowing the path that they're walking, knowing the adversaries they went up against and the consequences of their actions and those things. Did we see any kind of a through line thematically?
I feel like I'm being tested.
No, honestly, I just want to see. I'm curious to know because I might be just pulling on something, pulling cotton out of the pillow because I just think that that's something that works. But
the one that I found the fact that our introduction to Bill, the explanation for why she goes to the doctor's lectures, and she starts answering the question and then seems to tell an unrelated story. I don't think Moffat did that by accident. I don't think it's to tell us she's quirky. I think it's essentially metaphorical, or it's setting out sort of a form and function element, because she's basically laying out the concept of the butterfly effect. Mm-hmm. I started in this one place. This one thing happened. I did this. I saw her. I lusted for her in my heart. I gave her more chips. And then this totally unexpected outcome happened. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that keeps happening over and over again throughout the season, where you have small decisions, very small decisions, decisions that don't seem meaningful, that end up leading to a crisis situation or a setup of events that kind of cascades or is unexpected and is, maybe not the whole world away, but sort of similar to that.
Okay.
I don't know.
Jay, did you catch any sort of a through line thematically?
Preparing for the inevitability of loss.
Okay.
Kind of like what I was talking about with the tone, it was just a lot of closure and things like that. And it just seemed like that everything kind of pointed towards people are going to get lost. I mean, how many times do we point out that, Bill had a problem with the doctor just being so blasé about death? Mm. And it's, almost like he was getting ready or, getting her ready to be like, everybody dies, things end, I'm going to end one day. You need to be prepared for that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. She really never had regeneration explicitly laid out for her and explained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even with the pump fake regeneration that we got in Lie of the Land, it was still something that she really had no idea. He just yelled out, I'm regenerating. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Haley, did you get any kind of a common theme?
I don't know if this is really a theme, but it was something that appeared more than once. The idea that the Doctor might have to sacrifice Bill. We saw it in Oxygen, you know, when he fake killed her. Again, with the monks, when, you know, that might be the way you have to go to save the world is sacrificing Bill. And then again, at the end with the Cybermen, you know, she's the big, bad, evil robot that you might have to put down.
That actually points to one other thing that I noticed. And I find that really a compelling thought. But it makes me think about the fact that the Doctor is... there are more guns, there's more violence, there's more of the Doctor saying fire now, of him being in some fashion a commander or a military figure. It stands particularly in contrast to how he's president of the world, how unhappy he is about being president of the world in season 8 versus his willingness and quickness to claim that title in this season. So that there's a sense of him being willing to act on sacrifices in a different way.
And I'm not take sure responsibility for those decisions too.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that I feel like that's an arc that got fully played out. Like, I feel like it's teased a lot more than I'm comfortable saying it succeeded over the arc of the season, if that makes sense.
Okay. I think what I had picked up on, or actually what Julie was able to articulate, that she actually put it into a succinct term when I was just basically vacillating on all these things, was the theme of rescue. And the idea of, you can go ahead and choose your episode, but in many instances, the Doctor allowed Bill, you know, from the pilot to be the secret student in the class, take her on as a pupil to his tutorship, because he was going to rescue her from what she might not have even realized was going to be this succession of days that was life, you know, that she needed something more to it. You take it through to Oxygen and the matter of, you know, and all these adventures where they're answering distress calls. You know, you want to go where the action is, listen for where people are calling for help. And we were really getting back to what was a very tried and tested Whovian adage of just going where the red light is flashing and work from there. The whole idea of the rescue, even when you get down to the final pairing, the idea of the Doctor's attempts to try to find his way down to the base floors to be able to rescue Bill. She can't quite be dead. Wait for me, and on and on and on. And even it's not necessarily even just the Doctor too. There's also the matter of the theme of rescue, as far as the Doctor starting to make more reckless decisions and not being as cognizant of the collateral damage that could be caused if his decisions go off unchecked. Many times it's Bill being the one to step in, as the companion often does, but then there's also instances where Nardal uses the Doctor's own level of intelligence and rationalization to say, okay, nope, systematically, you know, you would, and so I'm going to give you your own rationale back. If you work this out logistically, it doesn't wash. So you need to belay that order and go on from here. Everyone is working towards a point of rescue, to success or failure. A lot of failure. I mean, someone just brought to my attention just the other day, and it was kind of a gutting thing that we didn't really explore when we were talking about the Doctor Falls, is that going forward into the Christmas episode and potentially beyond, depending on how the Christmas episode plays out, the Doctor currently believes the Master to be alive and Bill to be dead.
Yes.
I mean, that's hell. Talk about handing Chibnall the messiest ball of character status possible. This is all as a result of everyone's attempts to rescue one another. Bill's attempt to rescue the Doctor or save his eyesight causes the monks to take hold of the entire planet and their cognizance of history. I mean, it goes on and on and on and on and on. So I thought, you know, well, kudos to my wife for figuring that one out, because she came up with one word that I couldn't do in about 500. So I'm just going to turn to her when I need, hey, what's the theme? She can right. One word. Thank you. So aside from, we will be getting down to our, you know, our homecoming king and queen and all those wonderful superlatives in a later segment of the show here. But as far as the effectiveness of the series, let's say, you know, Moffat set out saying that this was one where he was basically doing, correct me if I'm wrong, he said on more than one occasion, he was resetting the show.
He could very much see it.
Okay. Yeah. So was he successful?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, there's not very many loose threads that I can think of off the top of my head. I mean, I'm sure if I went digging, I could find some, but for the most part, it's, I mean, everything pretty much got tied up.
I can smell. I can smell the smoke coming through Kathleen's microphone right now.
Maybe I'm just missing something to feel. I actually got to the end of the finale feeling like there were a lot of things left wide open, in the sense that there were questions that I had from the beginning or throughout the series that never were resolved. And I guess it's whether they're important questions or they're pedantic questions. I never really felt like I had a satisfying understanding of what Nardole's role was. I kind of wanted him to have more of a point as the keeper, as the person who came in and explained to the doctor, oh, maybe that doesn't play out like that. I can see what you're saying there, mm-hmm. Kier, but why does he, or how does he manage to have the moral authority to do that to the doctor? Why does the doctor listen to him?
Because River said so.
Listen to River that much. So that's a little odd. Why, you know, I guess the reason we have Susan on the desk and what seems to be references to family at the beginning is to set up the first doctor at the end. But there seems like there's going to be more about familial relationships than we actually get. Hmm. I don't know why he's a university professor. I'm not sure how he... Well, there are just a lot of little things that I get to the end. And what it ended up feeling like to me was there were so many little things that it is in some ways much more like a classic structure where you have little things, little things, little things, rather than big sweeping arc all the time. Right. And that's why I have that kind of butterfly effect thing, because there are little decisions. And I don't know that I feel like all those little decisions tie up to a satisfying whole. That said, there is the Christmas special. So maybe all of this is coming. Maybe the link of tears between Bill and the doctor will get explored. Or maybe that's just going to stay open.
Okay.
Bill's motivation as a companion. Maybe that's just never going to be explained. Maybe she just is an object and not a subject. I don't know. So I had a very different response to the series as a whole, I think.
No, and that's absolutely valid. I have to wonder to a certain degree, because you're discussing their particular, their justification, their placement, and their investment in the overall storyline. When it comes to Nardole and Bill specifically, Nardole, I don't know. I mean, I know, guys, we've talked about this. We've talked about him quite a bit over the course of the last 12 weeks or so to say, oh, you know, we came at the outset, we're wondering how quickly is he going to go?
Yeah.
You know, is this really going
to
work?
I was totally with you guys when you were saying that. I was like, yes, please.
But he kind of won in because of the fact that he kept being that representation of the Doctor being reminded of what he, of some of his own character traits historically. You know, Nardole is basically the verbal reminder of all of his past manifestations at one point or another, you know, and just saying, all right, sir, you in your shoes, that you're not standing in your own shoes right now, because your shoes would have told you X, Y, Z, move here, do this, don't talk to this person, spend your time with this, put your energy in this place, and so on. And that's why I'm kind of, why I was okay with Nardole's overall path, because by the end of it all, against his better judgment, Nardole developed a moral compass, and he didn't want one, but he got one, and now he's saddled with it, and he has to human farm for the next who knows how many years. But that's his path, because mm-hmm. if he is just, he's the cold reason and logic, he is the he's the intellectual mechanics of the Doctor to a certain degree. You know, which is why he kind of represents the classic Whovian viewer, because they say, well, you know, the Doctor clearly wouldn't make this kind of a decision, because if you remember back, you know, he wouldn't have made this call and this call and this call. And Nardole is that. So he always plays it, you know, straight to the line, you know, follows it to the letter. Whereas our modern companion is the one that's out pushing boundaries and asking questions and muddying the waters and being the fly in the ointment and on. So I think the fact that they start to come to a bit of a convergence, Bill starts to learn that as the universe is being opened up in front of her, she has to be aware of the fact that there are going to be casualties. She's not really happy with that. That's not something that someone in her heart of hearts can really accept, the fact that a single life can be lost. Whereas Nardole would come at it, you know, from a mathematical standpoint and say, well, you lose the few to save the many. It's the way it works. We've done this for millennia. It's just the way things are.
Right.
And they both have to come in a little bit at the end of 12 episodes. So I get that. I don't Fair. I don't necessarily know if I can take apart what his motivation or how he got into this mess really down to the nth degree, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Jay Haley, we've said that sometimes if you don't get an answer and it's left for you to fill in the gaps on it, that's sufficient for the sake of moving the story. Just tell me stuff happened. If you want to know more, fanfic.
Well, and if, I mean, if we take a step back and look at it, we've said it before, the show is a business. So if you look at it from a business standpoint or from the, you know, showrunner, Matt Lucas was brought in to be the comedic relief.
Sure.
That was his purpose. Yeah. And
so explicitly in the.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think he filled that role brilliantly because he was there to make with the funny and give Bill the chance to actually grow her character without things getting too heavy. Mm-hmm. So instead of trying to have serious character development and then wisecracking, which will take you completely out of it or just not seem right, it gave her the chance to do that kind of thing while still putting in the jokes to keep it entertaining. And the both of them working together in tandem, I think worked brilliantly. So I'm willing to overlook small bits of plot detail of like, okay, but why is he there? Well, he's there because he's funny, you know? So
that's totally fair. And I'm totally fine with him being funny. It's actually when I back up to the bigger picture where Kira's sort of pointing what you were pointing to of how the doctor that in some ways Nardole is all the history of the doctors and has this way of being able to see the big picture. I wanted there to be a reveal that why Nardole is smarter than the doctor or as smart as the doctor. Like I wanted that to have kind of a meaning. Like if he could have turned out to be Ramana, like I would have been delighted. Like
wow. Yeah.
Can't you see some of Nardole with Ramana One? Come on, a little bit? No.
Maybe a little.
But it's not so much that there is literally no plot way that the character that he's been throughout the course of the past 2 years could know the things that he's supposed to know in this series. Mm-hmm. It's just that since he was there every time and the doctor takes a second place to him, a second seat to him, I want him to be more than comic relief. And that's, you know, that's a personal preference of how I want the doctor to be. Mm-hmm. Like I want the doctor to have the most agency when it comes down to the bottom line.
Oh yeah. No, I get that. And I completely agree with you that when you look at the script and the plot and everything like that, there are definitely holes. There are definitely holes, but those are the moments when I kind of have to force myself to step back and be like, yeah, it's because of this. And so I'm just going to move on and enjoy the show.
Yeah. And there's no way if you're going to get completely stuck in trying to make everything work logically, you can watch Doctor Who for very long.
Exactly. You're watching the wrong show. Yeah.
Fair. One of the really critical points that I wanted to make sure that we got to take apart, because this is something that we started talking about real, real early, probably around the final, the closing moments of series 9, when we knew we were going to be dealing with a new companion, had to do with what we were going to anticipate from the next doctor companion relationship and how their symbiosis was actually going to, be conveyed. Haley and I sat in, I think it was at the last LI Who, where we ran a panel on that doctor companion relationship. We talked about all the historical different kind of pairings that we've had, and people started spitballing a little bit about what we were going to expect from the doctor with Bill. And I think a lot of people converged on the age difference and the background difference in the characters, that it was going to have to be something that that thankfully was going to take a bit of a break from the romantic interest, unless it was going to get really weird. But that it could very well be something very similar to Sylvester McCoy, the Seventh and Ace. Is that really what we got, do you think? They literally called it. I mean, she was the pupil to him as the tutor, so it's kind of the professor relationship. Haley, how did you feel that this actually resolved that or catered to that when all the dust settled?
If you were talking about like major archetypes for what a companion doctor relationship is, then yes, that's probably the closest. But it's not really the same. I haven't seen, I think, enough Ace to really articulate the differences. Tell that they were there.
Okay. I know. Well, I mean, Ace was rescued. Go back to your rescue theme. Was pulled away from a destructive set of life choices. You know, she was at a point where she could have descended into gang life and probably had her longevity cut short from you know, living on the streets. Bill, on the other hand, was coming into it a little differently. She was sort of in a rut, whether she really recognized it or not. And the doctor was there to be able to open her up to, obviously, you know, larger experiences. Very Rose-like in that regard. But what I kept pulling out of this was that Bill was the one doing all the teaching. The doctor was the one in a point of either myopic view, or at least he had put to rest the good man concern, but had no recollection of the individual who helped guide him there. You know, tragic as that is, you know, Clara stricken from memory, he's in a slightly better place, but doesn't necessarily know how he got there, which is maybe just as which casts you just as adrift, because now it's a matter of, all right, which way do I turn? I'm now alive in the center of the ocean, and I'm floating on this piece of driftwood. Now what? So we were talking about, how did he end up at the university? Why did he choose to take this vault from 1,000 years ago? And of all the places where he could have just sat on the thing for a millennium, he chose to go to, you know, this university and surround himself so that he can just sit there and spew forth his knowledge on ears that may or may not listen to him and pontificate about all the things that he finds fascinating. Maybe that's because his experiences with Clara that he doesn't recall has led him to believe that there is something to be treasured in the intricacy and the complexity of time and space. But he is also now much more cognizant, whether it's at a conscious or a subconscious level, of the dangers associated with it, because he watched Clara literally kill herself for her addiction to adventure. So now he wants to educate as many as he can so that he can interest them without endangering them. And maybe that's why Bill steps in as the one, this very intelligent young woman who wants to find more, and she's auditing these classes as a result of it. And he picks up on that and really kind of, you know, pulls her out of there and says, all right, we're going to do this carefully because you've got the aptitude and the opportunity to be able to do something exceptional. But if I do this, we're going to do this so that you don't come into harm. Well, that didn't work out very well, but you know, but that was his kind of, am I hitting anything here?
Yeah. I mean, that's the one thing that always came back to me was that they seem to go back to the classic companion kind of relationship, where the companion's sole purpose is to make the doctor explain things, but it's not in a, it's not in such an overt thing. It's, she is actually trying to understand the situation and forcing the doctor to question his own motives.
Yes.
And that was, it's such a better way of telling the story than just, you know, let me ask the question so you can expositionize it. I mean, it really dug into the
method of expositionize a word.
Yes.
Did he expositionerate at him?
But it, you know, it gave them the reason to delve into the methods behind, or the motives behind everything.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like you said, you know, Bill was definitely in a rut. She wanted more out of her life, but she didn't know how to get that. And the doctor, instead of saying, okay, well, I mean, originally it was, let me get you into school. That's the thing that you want to do, is you want to go to school and you want to, so let me start that. And then it just turns into so much more than either one of them ever dreamed it would have. Mm.
So, right, because, and that's kind of the back half of this. So we've been looking at, we always look at the companion's journey. Are they better or worse for the adventure? Did they get everything that they wanted, that they deserved, that really was their comeuppance and so forth? You know, people that had a negative opinion of Clara Oswald said, oh, you know, when she took a bird to the chest, that was the best thing that could have happened. You know, and no, 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 no. And people are going to make their statements. With Bill, I think, I don't know if you want to call that a tragic success. You know, the fact that her life as she knows it is completely gone, but now she has something that could potentially be far greater for her because she's found love. She's found the opportunity to have adventures at her own discretion, her own choice, and so forth, potentially mm-hmm. without harm. You know, can I hurt a bucket of oil? I don't know. But that's another conversation for another time. But the doctor was really the one to follow the arc. Is he in a different place now than he was at the pilot. And I guess that's really the question at the end of this all. It's he's the titular character. Has he advanced over the course of the past 12 episodes? Or regressed?
Yeah, you know, I'm going to say yes, because remember back at Thin Ice, he was starting to get a little cold and callous again. He saw the kid die, and he was ready to just move past it, move on to, you know, saving those that can be saved. And Bill was the one that was like, no, this child died. This is something that needs to be acknowledged. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it needs to be felt. And I feel like by the end of this series, he was starting to, you know, take notice of those things again and making sure that he felt the loss of every life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I could see moments where that was really starting to open up, or at least widen. And it was going from protect Bill to protect these people to protect this larger group to protect the world again. And yeah, he's back to that state of mind. Hopefully. I don't really know if he's at that state of mind now because of everything that has just disrupted. However, you know, he finds himself at this point.
Well, and that was an interesting kind of journey after, because we remember when he discovered the reason for his face was to remind himself to save whoever he can save. But then he forgot everything that Clara was a part of. So theoretically, he forgot that revelation that he had. So yeah, he would have gone back to being callous and you know, only focusing on what he thought was important at the time or whatever. So for him to rediscover again that he needed to save people, I mean, it's an interesting thing that we got that journey two times, and yet it didn't feel like a rehash.
No, it didn't feel like a rehash. It felt like, I'm just thinking this through as you were saying it, it felt in some ways like he had to, almost like a Groundhog Day thing. He had it a certain way and had to change to break out of the cycle, or not Groundhog's Day, even I should have used the Doctor Who reference. But where he ends this series, I think, is in a much less hopeful place than the analysis that you're just giving kind of implies. Mm. Like, I'm totally following you. I'm following you. And then I'm thinking of him in those final moments where his choices have been reduced to almost nothing except his anger and his desire to not leave, to not go, because he thinks these horrible things have happened. You know, he thought that Missy was alive, but he hadn't saved her. Mm-hmm. He thought he'd failed. Like, so he kind of thinks I failed. Yeah. So I agree with the general arc, but then when you follow that arc and see where he's left, I think it's a very sad ending.
It absolutely is. Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. In fact, I think that's what's really kind of interesting about everything that we have led up to this climactic moment within this final episode, knowing that we have, of all things, what is supposed to be a lighthearted, canned Christmas episode as our denouement, and you've got this complete shambles of all of the progress that he's made, or that he, well, progress may not be the right word, but all of this, this
experience,
I guess. Yeah. Or
I'm trying to think of a non-weighted.
Yeah. Word. Because this is a path that he has walked in to some degree many, many times, both on screen, and we have to imagine that, or we've been given implication that he has done this sort of thing and countless times over the course of millennia. So you'd think he'd learned by now. But the fact that these experiences still still hit him as hard as they do, or the fact that when a loss like this happens, or what he perceives to be a loss, and that's to me, again, this is still the real kicker of it, is that he's not in the know right now, which is usually when he's at his worst, or when he's at his most upset. You want to upset the doctor quickly, tell him he doesn't know something. And that's usually where things start to unravel real, real fast. So unless we're going to get, you know, some sort of a Christmas miracle that's going to bring him to the realization that yes, your efforts were merited all along. You are making the right advancements. You're on the right path. Stick it out. Oh, and please don't travel alone, because River would come back from the dead and kill you. This is a really interesting storytelling mechanism to get him this far and then suddenly say, but forget it. Now what? We're being pensive.
I So I know you guys can cut if you need to, but have you heard the casting
We'll discuss spoilers maybe after proper.
I don't want to go into a spoiler, but like that could work very well with the scenario you just set up.
Yep. And I know where you're headed with it, but we're going to leave that out for people to choose to pursue that further.
That's why I was like, I'm going to pause. There'll be some silence. Do cut that right out. It is interesting the way that this season or the series has allowed this particular incarnation of the Doctor to almost retry everything, retry saving the Master, retry dealing with the Cybermen, retry saving the Companion. And sometimes he has the same outcome and sometimes it's a different outcome. Mm-hmm. For the first time ever, he actually saved the Master. He's been trying for a long time. Well, no, saved them morally.
Well, does he know? And I was curious about that. I'm trying to figure this out.
Doesn't.
Go back. Does he know that he actually, his final impression was that she did double cross him.
Yeah.
And she's still out there at large.
Right. But from our broader perspective, he actually is for the first time in forever. Like he actually made some headway with the Master. Mm-hmm. And that is, has been posed to us over the last few seasons with Moffat as being this, and even with RTD and the John Sim Master, being this driving element of these two figures that are kind of interlocked forever.
Sure.
But here he's coming back to what you guys were saying earlier. He's closed the loop. Mm-hmm. He's actually succeeded in something he's been trying to do since he left Gallifrey.
Right. Which I was thinking about that a little earlier today, you know, as I know, Jane Haley and I have been talking about this, putting the psycho in psychotherapy over the course of this whole series. But then I thought about it today. I'm like, I don't think there could be a worse person to sit down and actually try and help you through mental disorders than the Doctor. He's in no qualification whatsoever to be able to help anyone make moral decisions or try to figure out what is my deep intent? What is my place within the world? You'd be better off just talking to the guy on a soapbox over on 7th. But
you'd actually be better off talking to the Master. I mean, if you could get the Master to be serious for a second.
At least they're of a singular mind.
The Master, in some ways, though, is like the witch from Into the Woods, where she says, you're not nice, or I'm not, you're like, it's this whole idea of you can be nice or you can be good, but you're not really very aware of what you're doing. It's not, you're not.
Yeah.
Right,
I might not be making the same choices you would, but at least I know what choices I've made.
Yes. And have perhaps a more stable notion of morality. The Master then is choosing to be immoral, or actually more accurately, amoral. But the Doctor can't seem to figure out what a good man is.
Mm. Yeah. So, all right. Well, I think this might be a decent opportunity to be able to back up to 15,000 feet and be able to just make nice full blanket statements about the series and the episodes within. So let's kind of tear into this. If I were to point at each of you and ask you to name what you believe to be, and I'm gonna distinguish here. I'm gonna ask you for a best episode of the series, but then I'm also gonna ask you to distinguish whether this may be different, the most entertaining episode, which are not necessarily one of the same for obvious reasons. So, Jay, I'm gonna jump on you first and ask you to give me what you believe to be the best overall episode of the series.
I've been struggling with this ever since we started the podcast, trying to figure out what I was going to go with. And honestly, I think that I have to go with the pilot.
Okay.
I think the pilot was a complete story, start to finish. It had everything that we could have wanted in it. I mean, it's become my go-to for introducing people to the show. I think that it was the best one out of this series.
You think it has replaced, because we used to talk about, you know, if you wanted to give somebody sort of an easy walk-in episode that we would hand them 11th Hour, whether or not you particularly liked the episode, but just as far as doing its job of introducing somebody to what the universe was all about, do you think that this replaces it?
Yeah. I've already replaced it. I've already used it on a new Whovian.
And it worked?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. She's almost through series 3 now.
Great.
Gotcha. Yeah, this is what I would say that with this one, with the pilot, you could probably introduce this one to someone and tell them not to watch anything else from series 10.
Mm-hmm.
Use this as a, okay, here's your premise, you know, here's your skeletal understanding and the kind of the way the Doctor occasionally will interact with humans that he cares about and humans that he doesn't care about. Now, here's some other entry points where you can jump in wherever you feel comfortable. Yeah, I get it.
I think the only thing you're really missing there is regeneration.
True.
Yeah, but if you're...
need it when you're introducing someone. So, I mean, I don't have a problem with that as an introductory episode. But, I mean, a lot... You're absolutely right. It's got a lot of the dynamic and the notion of what the Doctor, who the Doctor is, and what he's about.
Mm-hmm. So,
Kathleen, and also the crazy time.
Would you agree then, Kathleen, that the pilot is the pinnacle of the season, or is the gem of the season?
This question is really tough for me. I had much more of a sense of good moments than of whole good episodes. I think I really like Oxygen, actually.
Okay.
As it was happening, I think that in retrospect, after the finale, Pilot leaps up to being a much better episode, or an episode I enjoy and see as being much more complete than I did on first view. Mm. As an effective story, I think the second to last one, World Enough in Time, is okay. Like getting on a roller coaster. And you are in Rachel Talalay's hands, and you're not getting off that roller coaster no matter what. It's a ride.
Yeah. That's where my vote currently lies, is for World Enough Time as best episode. Absolutely agree with you, Jay, as far as the pilot, if you're going to be using it for that particular purpose, hands down, you know, that hits all of the notes. And in fact, I think it's good to leave regeneration out of it, because that's something that then when people go to watch subsequent episodes and something like that comes into the mix, now everything has just been expanded that much wider. Wait a second. So now that he doesn't have a finite lifespan, and then we're going to do this all again in some different permutation now. And that just, you know, it can potentially, hopefully, build the interest in the universe that much farther. But World Enough in Time, as far as best episode in terms of really boiling down the characters, where they are at this moment within the entire pantheon of the show. You know, this is where the Doctor really stands right now, and these are the things that are of critical importance to him. This is how his companion is so deeply rooted to this, that even after this nearly fatal moment, their connection is that strong that she waits us out to some, you know, tremendously indescribable amount of time. The Master is this, and the Master is also this, you know, and you get those things as well. So I think that's, as far as just an episode where you sit back and go, damn, that's probably World Enough in Time. Haley, where would you put your 25 cents?
This was a tough decision, but I'm going to go with The Doctor Falls. I really like kind of the closure of it, the finality of it, everyone kind of making their own decisions, whether they get to carry out what those decisions are or not. Like seeing Missy make the decision to go back and stand with the Doctor, even though she didn't get to do it. That was such a huge moment for me across since her introduction. That's what pushed that one up.
Okay. If we then have to turn the table a little bit and talk about the episode that is the most entertaining, which isn't necessarily the best episode, how would you cash your ballots a little differently? Jay, how would you change from the, if at all, from the pilot?
All right. No, I'm definitely going different, but see, the World Enough in Time was almost my pick for best episode, and it was almost my pick for most enjoyable. But I have to, with the amount of fun that I had, I have to go with Extremis, because it was just trying to figure everything out, trying to figure out what was real and what wasn't, how this was all going to play out and everything. It was just so much fun being clueless for so long.
Yeah. I think that was the only episode this entire season that the moment the credits rolled, I had to back up and watch it again.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Normally on a second rewatch, it's the next day, the next morning, something like that. But no, this one was right in the heels.
Instantaneously, yeah.
I just want to... Was that... Am I still in the Matrix? Am I not in the Matrix?
Where
layer
are we now?
Of Inception what? Is this?
Okay. Exactly, yeah.
Kathleen, where would you change your... if you change your vote at all?
I think that I probably would change my vote, although like a secondary vote for extremists, because anything that has popes and manuscripts and I'm all in for, which is explains why I'm so very into the Eaters of Light, because, you know, you have the Imperial Roman Army, they're looking for the Ninth Legion, and then it's just so much fun because there are set pieces and it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. It starts out being so small and then getting bigger and bigger. And as an episode that makes me want to, and I don't write fanfic and I don't actually read Doctor Who fanfic, but that one almost makes me want to, because okay. I want to know what happens to those people. And that to me is one notion of what an entertaining episode is that you want to keep living in that world.
Okay. Haley, where would you go with this?
I might have to agree with Jay and say extremists for the Pope in the bedroom, if nothing else.
Exactly.
This is a piece of information you need to know. If I'm on a date, do not put the Pope in my bedroom. This has to be said.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely had all the points from the audience confusion factor, which we still thrive on to a certain degree. We like to be at a loss every once in a while, as long as we know we're going to get some explanation, whether it's on the first viewing or the second. I had to go with Thin Ice. Simply okay. because it yeah. was, as far as, because this was, I'm looking at it as most entertaining. So I wanted mm-hmm. something that I knew was going to be buttoned up. I was going to have my resolution. I was going to get something redeeming from my characters, maybe see them progress a little bit, get some memorable moments, and come on, you know, punch to the racist, always a good moment. And had some things that kind of gave you a moment's pause as well, you know, like the doctor's reflection on accepting losses and things of that sort. So I thought that one had a lot going in that regard as far as just a sheer entertainment factor. Unfortunately, if we're going to talk superlatives, we have to talk about what we would consider to be the weakest link of yeah. the series. Mm-hmm. So Jay, I have a feeling I know where you're going to go with this, but I want you to actually say it out loud.
Surprisingly, I was actually amazed that looking over the list, it was not the Mark Gatiss episode. I know.
Sorry, I had to think of Free Scarrow on Sleep No More.
So.
Yeah, we all have that kind of gag reflex every time that name comes
yeah.
up.
Yeah. Well, as much as I wanted to like it, and as much as there were parts of it that I did enjoy, I've got to go with Knock Knock.
Yeah.
It felt like the weakest conclusion. There were so many things that could have been different to make it a better story, and it just fell kind of flat for me.
Did it feel to you, I'm looking at this retrospective, I think I've probably watched it about 3 or 4 times now. I just came back to it recently just to see whether or not I had gotten the right tone from it, that it seemed like a flimsy RTD era episode where you make up a little beastie just to mm-hmm. for the sake of getting you from point A to point B, and we all react to it, and we have to have somebody who speaks on behalf of the beasties mm-hmm. in order to explain why the beasties are the beasties. No. And then we get some sort of a solution that has to do with heart tug credits.
Yeah.
Actually, I'd even say not just RTD, but almost Sarah Jane Adventures.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
There you go, yeah.
In the fact that just about everybody gets pulled back out of the woodwork, yeah. literally.
And when we talked about that episode, I talked about how I was pulled out of the episode as soon as everyone started dying. It's like, well, we're not going to end it there.
Yeah.
And they're just magically reconstituted.
Exactly.
It's fine. Brilliant.
I will say, though, that just as the episode aired, that's the one I'd have to pick. But going back and watching some of the deleted scenes from Series 10, there were a couple scenes that got pulled out of Knock Knock that, while not making it a better episode, helped me to understand the character a little bit better, the character of the landlord. So if you can get a hold of that, a huge thanks to Charlie Floyd Bennison, who shared the link with us on our Facebook. But that helped me to understand that character so much better that I actually went back and watched the episode again and found it more enjoyable.
Okay.
I didn't get as pulled out when the resolution happened. So
Kathleen, would you agree that Knock Knock was probably the low point of the series?
That's a really tough one. Knock Knock definitely wasn't my thing. I'd also probably, if I could split that quarter we were putting and into a diamond, two nickels or something to that effect, yeah. I would also put some money on the pyramid at the end of the world.
Okay.
Yeah.
That really over a lie of the land as the last one of that trio.
I guess I want to throw that storyline.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's, gotcha. That's where those nickels are.
Yep. I think Lie of the Land was probably, I think we all kind of agree that that was probably the weakest of the point, because it kind of felt like Toby Whithouse was stuck with here. Moffat created this great villain, came up with this great concept, and then started going in a very unusual direction with it with Peter Harness in Pyramid, and then Toby's left to wrap it up.
Yeah.
And that may be one of those things where real life affected the story that they were able to tell there, I'm afraid. And I definitely agree, like, that the Lie of the Land is Toby Whithouse is working uphill there.
Yeah.
But it's probably the one I think that has the fewest, not stand up and cheer exactly, but the fewest moments that I hold as positive and meaning Doctor Who to me. That stick in my head.
I get that. Yeah.
See, I think the Pyramid at the End of the World could be much more enjoyable if you play the drinking game of every time you see a blatant disregard of safety regulations, drink.
Oh, yeah.
Plastered in the first 2 minutes. Plastered in the first 2 minutes.
I didn't hear you guys do your podcast on these two, because this is about when I tore up my elbow and was on too many drugs to understand Doctor Who.
Probably would have made our cast more enjoyable.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, with that drinking game. I'm going to go back and listen to that one. That's really...
Every time you see the guy with the OSHA badge, just check off his little notepad. No, 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 no. Yeah. Haley, where would you go with weakest episode of the season?
Lie of the Land. It just did not do it for me.
Okay. And I guess the last one that I put on here would be the one thing, whether it's within an episode or maybe it's something about through the series as a whole, that if you had the opportunity to sort of bend Moffat's ear and say, you know what, you might want to, and whisper something in, what would be the one thing that you would have changed to better the series, either within a single story or overall? Jay?
I think I would have probably reversed the order of the three-parter. Had Whithouse started out, then do the Peter Harness one, and then have Moffat close it, because Moffat's episode, without a doubt, was the strongest of those three, and I think that he might be able to craft a better conclusion to something that the other two laid. Or even if he comes up with the loose premise of the entire trilogy and lets them do their thing on the first two and then buttons it up at the end, instead of, here's a great opening, a brilliant thing, now you two, you know, live up to that. It didn't work out.
Okay. Kathleen, did you have anything that you would have done as a steering correction to the series if it needed anything?
Oh, a steering correction.
Nothing blatant. It's not like, you know, drive a spike through Mark Gatiss's eye or something like that. It's just more subtle. subtle.
If only because he has a beautiful sock game, you know, with his suits and, you know, that fashion would be missed from the world.
But he's dash cunning.
There are moments that read a little tone deaf at times. I actually did have a little bit of a problem with him punching the racist. Okay. I think there are some things like that, as there always are a little bit with Moffat, where when you back up from them, you're kind of like, oh, hun, I wish you'd thought through the implications of what you were saying on a world stage. I take out all the Trump jokes. I don't think they play as well to the listener as they probably did in the writing of them, and I don't think they'll play as well in the future.
Okay.
And I would change Bill's ending. I'm not happy.
Meaning you'd rather her stay converted and be the original Cyberman to sort of...
No, I would. I'm not happy about the fact that we have a companion who is a woman of color, who's queer, and who essentially is erased bodily, loses her agency, basically begs for a kind of assisted suicide, and then when she displays emotion is shut down for being an angry and dangerous woman. So yeah, I found that very problematic.
Understood. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think.
Sorry, I know. No, no, no.
These are conversations we've been having throughout. You know, there was a whole concern as to whether or not they were actually going to be fridging her character in so much before we knew, you know, what this sort of this this last minute save, if you really want to call it that, took place, and you know, and why this is something where it as Haley picked up on last week, the fact that this is feeling an awful lot like the Clara and me reset. That says, well, you know, once again, dead isn't dead, but not only is dead not dead, dead is also an invitation to become a superpower forever and ever, amen. But not in the form that you would actually expect or in anything that actually relates back to your life. So now your life is irrevocably changed, but isn't it for the better now? And off you go.
But it's not what the character wants, and she explicitly says, this isn't what I want. It's the best lemonade that you can make from those lemons. And it would be nice to see a character, I mean, I know we can't do this with modern companions, but basically bowing out on their own and deciding based on their own needs, wants, and desires.
Well, Stephen Moffat, for whatever reason, has decided that nobody would ever choose to stop traveling with the Doctor. So right. Everyone is forced out of their travels.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Martha, Martha, Martha.
She tried to make a decision, and it just kind of came back and came undone.
True. Well, you folks want to get to some news? I don't know if you want to dig into this so early, seeing as how it's still, as we are recording this, still July. You know that a number of different tabloids, primarily on the British side of the pond, are going to continue to dig at hints of what we will be seeing from the Christmas episode. I don't know. Personally, I know there's more than half of my brain that says, just surprise me, do something amazing, give me a great story, make it a true Christmas present. I just, you know, happy, sad, good, bad, I just surprise me. But I know that based on what we do every week, that's probably not allowed to happen.
Yeah.
Sadly, that's. I mean, do you really want to keep your ear to the ground for this stuff, or do you want to try to actively avoid it as much as we realistically can?
I personally, at this point, I wish I could like sleep until Christmas so that I don't catch anything coming out of the, because it's. Yeah, unfortunately, there are those people that are like, they go digging and they demand to know every bit of information they can. And then as soon as they find it, they shove it down everybody else's throat because people need to know. And I don't want that. I would love to be able to go into it and just be surprised. But unfortunately, like you said, nature of the business, I don't think that's going to happen for us. But
can you imagine how delightful it would have been to not know John Sim was coming?
Yeah.
Been reading the articles lately about how much they had hoped that they could keep the lid on that for as long as realistically possible. But you can always thank the sun for being the sun, can't you?
Yeah.
I would
just start filming stuff somewhere besides Cardiff.
It is a problem because, you know, you have the first Doctor wandering around in Cardiff. Ooh, isn't that mildly suspicious?
Where do all the British people go to vacation? Like, start filming there.
Isle of Wight.
Ibiza?
Related to that sort of idea of the rumors, the suppositions, the betting pools, and on and on and on, we can probably take... We can, for all intents and purposes, we can really take a couple of names off the list that we had been hearing a bit about, some we had been really hoping about, but I think the kibosh has officially been put down. Thanks, Craig. We appreciate the email that we got into the feedback line about what was going to be happening with Phoebe Waller-Bridge, if you recognize her from Fleabag. He was picking up on a lot of the hints that she was in the running for this, and that during the that stifled regeneration that happened within the Doctor Falls, when he tamps it back down, there's a moment where his facial features start to change, and he was convinced as he went through frame by frame, this is what we've become, people. Frame by frame, he was going through and said, his eye, I think he was saying the eye sockets and the jawline were starting to resemble Phoebe. He was not alone.
Yeah. No. Yeah, there were a lot of people who thought that that was the case, actually.
Yeah. And she had to be the one to come forward and say, nah, dog. Not going to happen.
You know what I wish they had done is, like, several times his face had started to regenerate and they had just, like, superimposed a different actor every single time.
But everybody that was on the rumor list so far.
All these betting pools, whoever, like, the top were in there. Oh, it would have been great.
One after another. Just boop, 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 boop.
Yeah.
Like he was having some sort of allergic reaction to bee stings or something and his face just kept puffing and...
like changing colors and different amounts of facial hair.
This should be the outtakes that they use for comic relief or something.
Only if the last one right before he stifles it back down is Eric Roberts. And he just says, no! Boom! And just pounds his fists into the ground.
Oh,
anything
God.
But that.
I like it.
But to add to that list of names you will probably not see coming around, and we got a lot of people that were really holding out hope, I think against better judgment and reason. I really didn't think this had much of a shot at all, but Hayley Atwell will, with all likelihood, just not going to come around as our 13th Doctor because she simply doesn't want to.
No, I don't believe it. I think this is just trying to keep the rumors in check. That's all it is.
Yeah.
No, I'm not done. Yeah. Not giving up hope.
Whatever it is she wants to do, I'm in for it. I'm watching it. I'm probably already buying the t-shirts, but it's not going to be her stepping out of the TARDIS.
Wait, you were buying the t-shirts for that horrible lawyering show she was in?
No.
Just left?
No.
It wasn't horrible.
It was pretty bad. I'm totally in for her getting something better, but not anything she'll do because I couldn't even watch that. And
I watched all of that. You do not love her well enough.
Wow. That's hardcore, and I bow down.
I don't know why you would ever choose to make her do an American accent. That seems like a bad decision.
Yeah, no, that's horrible.
Just keeps happening.
It's one of those things that I don't know why Americans don't seem to realize. Keep the British accent. It always works better.
Always
Americans
better.
Like it, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Jay, what's our last item for the night?
So this the last news article that we've got is actually just... It's very interesting. There have been, ever since the reintroduction of the Cybermen into New Who, there have been a lot of people complaining or trying to figure out how it works that we've got two different kinds of, I mean, this isn't the first time that we've gotten them though. We've got Cybermen popping up all over the place and everybody trying to point it back to one individual instance that kind of ties it together. And with this latest episode, Moffat just kind of said, no. Every one of those origin stories that we got, when they're coming from that's just what happens. People plus technology minus humanity, Cybermen. Yep. And it's a really interesting way of kind of pointing at it and saying all of this happens simultaneously everywhere. It's inevitable.
I like the fact that we get to put on our big proud britches because we called this the week before the Doctor falls and say, you know what? We probably think that their justification for having the Mondasian Cybermen come back is because this is the path that they're going to walk regardless of what situation you put them in because these people are genetically predisposed to replace themselves with toasters. So that's just what they're going to do. And that was the way the speech worked out.
Pretty much,
It's there is no evil plan, no evil genius. It's just parallel evolution. This is just when they get faced with the situation where their species is in dire peril, they turn to cybernetics as their way of surviving. And whether it's happening on a colony ship or it's happening on their planet, which is, you know, collapsing or any other situation, that's where they're going to go to because that's just the way that they are, they're wired.
And it's really not that far off from reality. I mean, look at the extent that we've taken prosthetics to at this point. And as technology gets better, I can totally see people being like, no, just give me the whole updated chest piece. Like, I never want to worry about cholesterol again. Mm. Yeah, so yeah, I can totally see this being an actual evolutionary process.
Yep, I'll start changing my voicemail now to reflect my better speech patterns. Yeah. There you have it. We are vindicated.
Exactly. It's almost like we know what we're talking about sometimes.
Sometimes. On occasion.
Once or twice.
But next week, we'll know nothing.
Oops, sorry.
That's all right.
I was going to say, it's not that you don't know what you're talking about. It's just that everything keeps changing.
Damn it.
Not your fault. You have all the knowledge in the world. The world just changes.
Exactly. It's like Indiana Jones says, everybody's lost with me.
Because I already have the bodysuit.
What was last Monday?
Sorry. What's up for next week, Jay?
So next week, we're actually going to be joined by Danica and Brandon from Dr. Hooch as we just get completely plastered and talk about Moffat.
I mean, it requires drinking. It doesn't have a drinking game along with it. It's just that's where we're going to get to as we reflect on the tenure of Stephen Moffat. We did one similar to this when we had heard his announcement that he was going to be stepping down. And now we just want to take kind of a look back and tell him that you did a good job, Charlie Brown.
Yeah.
Essentially. In so many
details. Or not. Depends on how drunk we get.
Yeah.
Could go very the other way.
It could fall off the rails, and then it just becomes Guy Fawkes Day. I don't really know, but we'll have to see.
I've already got the effigy set up. No.
Just like magnifying glasses in the sun. Just
no problem. Fire. Avoid fire. Alcohol fire. Bam.
Oops. Okay.
So. All right. This has been episode 241 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, so 160, how many days till Christmas?
And this is Kier saying, I don't care how many new versions of these Cybermen you're going to give me. Just please don't start coloring them red, yellow, blue, white.
And this is Haley saying, fire bad, tree pretty.
This is Kathleen saying, was that all just a dream?
We will see you guys next week.
I will see.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.gunnageek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.